LMC. You're listening to the LMC Radio Network, broadcasting out of Forestville, California, on the World Wide Web at LuckyMojo.com.
All right, everyone, here we go. Let's build that energy. Reverend James, hit the music.
Welcome to Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places, exploring the magical world around us, only on the LMC Radio Network. There are so many fantastic, exciting, and curious things that make up this world we share. Come join us as we explore the spiritual, magical, and wondrous phenomena that enrich our souls and bring color to our days. I am your announcer, Reverend James of FolkConjure.com, located in Western North Carolina. This week, we welcome our special guest, Doc Murphy of RootDocMurphy.com in the Twin Cities of Paganistan, Wisconsin, bringing us what's sure to be an outstanding discussion on ethical eclecticism in your magical practice. In just a moment, we'll be joined by our host, Reverend Art of FolkConjure.com in North Carolina, and our guest, Doc Murphy. Make sure you're logged into Blog Talk Radio and join in the discussion via the chat. Now, let's catch up with our host. Reverend Art, take it away.
Thank you, Reverend James, and welcome everyone to Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places, the Monday Night Phenomenon. And as always, if it's Monday, take a few moments, jump on over to Facebook, go to the Hoodoo Psychics Facebook page, and like the and drop a comment on the mid-post to win your chance at a free 15-minute reading. That's a $60 value with the Hoodoo Psychic of your choice. A lot of great readers out there. A lot of big questions to get answered. Don't miss out on your chance. That is weekly on the Hoodoo Psychic's Facebook page. All right. So much excitement for tonight. Can't wait to really get into the discussions and everything. But before we do that, going to bounce back over to you, Reverend James. How are things with you?
Well, I'm just noticing, because I thought it sounded weird, Wisconsin is wrong, because that's not where Doc Murphy is at. She's in Minnesota. So, yeah. Other than that...
Reverend Art's a little directionally challenged.
He is something.
Can't read map good.
I've been updating a few of the labels for our candles, our vigil candles. I'm sure everybody's still aware that that's going on, but Art got most of them up on the website the other day, but realized that a handful of them were missing. So I have been working on those today. And those of you that know that I'm playing around in the AI art circles online, I had a little side project today where someone had created a image of what they thought would be a really neat perfume or cologne bottle. And their name on AI art website is called Eastern Indigo. So they put that in kind of as like a prompt. They put their name in as a prompt. And it came out with this very pretty blue indigo colored bottle with Eastern architecture etched into the bottle. And the name of the perfume or cologne was Eastern. And they happened to come up with some scents that they would have put in it if it were real. And when they put that in the chat, I'm like, oh, I think I'll give that a shot and try to make it. So that was a little side project I was in doing today, and it was fairly interesting. It actually smells pretty good.
Having had a chance to actually to sample the, I don't know, what do we call it, the prototype scent, I was quite surprised. It's something that would most likely make a very good cologne. So we're going to, I guess what's next, Reverend James? We let it mellow for a day and then see how the scents blend, correct?
Yep, and then we're going to dilute it a little bit, because when you dilute it, it kind of brings out those little subtler things, subtler scents, subtler notes. And we'll see where it goes from there. Who knows? We might end up actually making it a cologne that we sell as an oil or an alcohol perfume cologne or an aftershave, something like that maybe. Who knows?
Very cool. And, yeah, like I said, I know we've been saying it for a couple weeks now. We are on the very cusp of getting the new improved Vigil candles out onto our website. Not going to Etsy first this time. We are jumping right out to the website. Hopefully within the next couple days should be able to get that finished up and unveiled for everyone. Have some really interesting services that are coming along, kind of riding on the coattails of those. Really want to talk about them. Going to save that for some upcoming Facebook Lives. So if you're not already a follower on folkconjure.com or Folk Conjure's Facebook page or Folk Faith Ministries Facebook page, I'm going to be definitely doing some live broadcasts there. So excited. But so very excited to welcome our guest back today. Every time she joins us, it's a wonderful experience for all. How are things going, Doc Murphy? Welcome back.
Hi, Reverend Art. Hi, Reverend James. And hi, everybody in the chat. I'm doing fine. I'm in the afterglow after Paganicon. I was there Friday through Sunday. And I didn't realize how much I needed the break and how much I needed to be with my tribe and my community. And I presented on camp with Velvet, who some of you got to know a couple episodes back when we talked about the Cultural Archive of Modern Paganism. Also attended a workshop or two and actually spent a lot of time in the Hay River Fire Haven Suite, where I'm now a board member. Our pagan church that is just submitted our 501c3 paperwork, so fingers crossed that nothing screwy happens there. And I'll be perfectly honest, I think I drank more this weekend than I have in the last 6 weeks, but it was all really, really good.
It was a party.
It was great. Well, I was hosting, sharing a room with two friends of mine, pagan friends of mine, who were visiting from Missouri. And this, a lot of us in Paganistan, this is our umpteenth Paganicon. We kind of know how it goes. This was brand new for them. And just watching just the, coming from a pagan community where they are, that's not Paganistan. You know, it's tiny, it's kind of insular, and then they walk into a hotel room and the whole hotel is full of pagans and pagan vendors and workshops, and everybody that's in there is, you know, into what you're into too, and you don't have to explain yourself. We've gotten pretty spoiled in Paganistan. We have a long history. It's urban, it's big. We can sit in bars and talk about spell work and root work and ritual and what athame we're going to use for what season. And like, no one cares because it's just Paganistan. This meant a great deal to them, and they had a lot of fun. They got a little overwhelmed. I feel a little bad about, because I was like, oh yeah, you'll get overwhelmed. And I should have said, you're going to get overwhelmed. They're going to come back next year, and they're going to bring even more friends. And that's the idea. You know, it's just, the whole point is that if we can stretch interest in that particular gathering to, you know, it's countrywide that we get guests. So it was a lot of fun. And there's a lot of folks reported back after a lot of the rituals were particularly energetic this year. Like I said, there's a lot of people who we bumped into that said, this was my first time, and I'm just stunned. I'm so glad I'm here. And, you know, we were just having a great time. I have to admit, the oddly enough, the best joy and the laughingest time I had, there's something about sitting in the suite of a fellow pagan church and with your whiskey and your friends and playing a game of Cards Against Humanity with a bunch of pagans. it had been a long time since I laughed so hard that I fell on the floor, but that needed to happen too. So it was spiritually meaningful. It was great to be able to talk to people about the process, progress we've made it with camp. We actually has also created a couple new things. If you visit the website or email anybody who's on the board, and our information's on the camp website, Cultural Archive of Modern Paganism, paganarchive.org. There's a membership, kind of a sustaining membership, that if you like to support camp that way, kind of be a sort of a sustainer, and then you get sort of a newsletter about the progress of camp every 3 months that Velvet will send to you. And we have what's called a glamper level, where for a particular amount, again, you have to contact, check the site or contact Velvet about the specifics, or our president, Kim, whose contact information is also on the site. For a particular glamping donation, the prize of that is that we told people we will do an oral history of anyone in the community of your choice. You know, we are obviously, for this historical project, we're making sure that our elders and our septuagenarians and octogenarians get their stories recorded. We got word that we lost another really influential elder just a couple of weeks ago, and wow. I'm kicking myself that things didn't fall into place in time before he passed suddenly. So, you know, assuring people that, like, no, we're not going to leave you behind, but you do have to wait your turn it's definitely a turnaround from where we were a couple of years ago, when folks weren't sure if we could be taken seriously. And now people are excited and really ready to support. And so that was invigorating, and that was fun, because, you know, Velvet presented her work. She did a research project on the Hidden Falls Park incident in Paganistan in 1991 using the data that we'd collected thus far as a result of camp, and she did a superb job. So it was just good. It was good for people to see not only that we're 501c3ing, that we have a board, that we have an advisory board of great people too, how research is going to be used, you know. And then after we wrapped up our presentation, we hit the bar. It was great.
you know, we've talked about Paganicon, you know, in passing on previous shows and everything. I really don't know, for anyone that hasn't taken the time to at least check out the website for Paganicon, I really don't know that everyone has a kind of a grasp on really kind of the enormity of this event. Reverend James and I had hoped to be able to make it this year. Unfortunately, for reasons, it didn't happen, although next year is definitely on the table. I was personally just blown away at, you know, the workshops that are presented. And, you know, I was reading through lists of vendors and, you know, just, you know, it truly is kind of a, you know, a foundational community building event. It's kind of like the poster child of what really it should be kind of going on around the country, to build that consciousness, to build that awareness, to build the understanding, to build the bridges in the communities, and really kind of, you know, bring that unity around. I've listened to several individuals that attended at different times, and I'm a little bummed that we couldn't make it this year. But it's definitely something that if anyone's in the region or, I don't know, looking to travel, it's kind of like almost a kickoff to the spring season, you know? This really something worth checking out. And that camp was able to participate and grow and really kind of start to find that footing this year is fantastic. Absolutely thrilled to hear that it went swimmingly for both you and for Velvet. So
it was really great to feel that support, and it was really great to kind of feel the excitement. And I'm looking in the chat right now, folks asking questions about it. It's not mostly Wiccan based. Paganicon is anyone who wants to attend, really. Multi-faith, multi-tradition. We have the hospitality suites are run by organizations or by other groups where you can go and socialize and make those connections. But witches come. There was an entire suite. The Druids were doing karaoke. The heathens are usually make a big presence. All sorts of a lot of the workshops are done by folks that are of a particular pagan tradition or ethnic tradition or whatever, and that's a chance to get educated about everything else that's out there. The overlaps are, you know, that's the kind of the whole point is that we all learn from each other, and we all, you know, find those things about pagan community that, you know, I even argued way back in my dissertation days is that for all the talk that pagans say about, oh, we're all so unique and eclectic and decentralized and different, it's just hard for us to kind of get together. Well, you know what? There's some things that we really do cohere on, and it's on these basic things that we connect and that we can find comfort in each other at Paganicon. You know, it's community, and then there's in smaller areas there's fellowship, right? And you know, especially for folks who, and I really got a reappreciation of this. You know, my guests reminded me that they came from a part of the country where, you know, their community is small. The external pressures from, you know, Bible Belt types are very hard. It's still a place where you have to be very careful and circumspect about your religion and your practices. And then when communities are small and insular like that, when internal skirmishes occur, they can be, you know, they can blow communities apart just because there's small, you know, amounts of people in it and you know, just too much can happen. And for them to have the folks that come from other parts of the country that have, you know, kind of a smaller frame of reference for their community to be able to come and see, yeah, this is, your movement is huge. It's worldwide, it's national. And you don't have to feel stuck and whatever it is that you're doing, when you see a world of different expressions of modern paganism all sitting underneath this hotel, having dinner together, going to workshops together, dancing with the blues band together, and going to the ball wearing costumes and laughing their butts off at Cards Against Humanity on the floor. You know, it's you kind of can relax into your culture and your community there. And Paganicon is Twin Cities Pagan Pride sponsors it and puts it on. Paganicon is really for us. It's for people that want more advanced a praxis and education, who want to make those community connections. They do an event every fall, which is Pagan Pride Day, and they tailor that more to general public, introductory level things. What is Wicca? What is paganism? Vendors. And it's more of a sort of an outdoor festival at one of our big parks here in Minneapolis. So they always just kill it every year. They do such an amazing job putting on Paganicon and getting things going. So we look forward to it every year, and we all love to participate. So yeah, I definitely encourage folks who are interested, you know, jump when the hotel rooms become available, because those are the first things that sell out. But then, you know, drive up, fly out, join us. You're going to have a great time, and you're going to meet some amazing people that will change your life.
Grab a broom, magic carpet, whatever it takes to get there, huh?
You got it. Teleport, whatever.
No, it really is. You know, there I've been around, you know, up and down the East Coast of the U.S. and I've attended a lot of different pagan festivals, a lot of psychic fairs, spiritual expos, et cetera, et cetera. And as far as from what I've seen is what the Twin Cities puts together with Paganicon, it is one of the best. I would have to say one of the most well put together, well thought out and presented cons that I have personally experienced. Well, not personally experienced for Paganicon, but it just, you know, from seeing how well growing and expanding. We'll be there. You will see Reverend James and I, maybe even for Pagan Pride Day.
Oh, that would be wonderful to have you come up in the fall and visit. That would be terrific.
Yeah, someone's told me so much about the winter time there, so I'm a little nervous about that time between Pagan Pride Day and Paganicon. So we'll have to make the other two dates work.
Well, we've been fortunate during the last few Pagan Pride Days that have been out at Minnehaha Falls in the park have been really beautiful. They've been gorgeous days, beautiful weather. You want to be by the falls in the park on Pagan Pride Day, and of course it's outdoors, and it's. You know, we've been very fortunate that the weather for the Pagan Pride Day here is still early enough in the fall, and summer still lingers a little bit, that we've had some absolutely beautiful outdoor days. And, you know, Paganicon in a hotel. again, for folks that drive out, we've lucked out with the weather this year because it just never snowed in Minnesota this winter. It just didn't because of the El Nino. It was just weird as hell. But, you know, people negotiate it, you know, they figure out a way to do it, and yay for hotels, you know.
Fantastic. Well, you know, I do want to mention one thing before we jump over into our little sponsor segment and jump into the topic for today is for those who are as big a fan of Doc Murphy as I am, go out and check out her blog on rootdocmurphy.com and leave comments and leave love and encouragement, because we need her to write some more. If y'all haven't read her blog, her blog is...
I don't take comments. I don't have time to read them.
Her blog is fantastic.
Oh, thank
for
you.
Y'all, if y'all haven't read it, if y'all haven't checked it out, it's truly an experience. So definitely go and check out her blog. I'm waiting for the next installment. So maybe if we all get together, Doc Murphy will grace us with more words.
It'll happen. It'll happen. With the whirlwind of Paganicon and camp and everything else that's been going on. And of course, you know, my day job, it's been a whirl, but things are going to settle a little bit. And I really want to do sort of a, you know, field notes from Paganicon kind of entry, but there's some of the stuff I have to kind of sift out to make sure that it's about Paganicon and not about, you know, me laughing on the floor playing cards against humanity. So.
All right. Well, that being said, I think this is a perfect time for a few messages from our sponsors, and then we'll jump back into ethical eclecticism.
The LMC Radio Network is a media alliance whose excellent shows include The Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour with Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman, Sundays, 3 to 4:30, Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places with Reverend Art and Reverend James, Mondays, 4 to 5:30, The Crystal Silence League Hour with John St. Germain, in syndication, Tuesdays, The Witch, the Priestess, and the Cauldron with Elvira Love and Miss Phoenix LeFay, in syndication, Tuesdays, The Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield, in syndication, Wednesdays, and The Witch, the Priestess, and the Cauldron with Elvira Love and Deborah Voith, Thursdays, 4 to 5. All times specific, add 3 hours for Eastern, sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com.
Now for some quick announcements about those outstanding upcoming shows on the LMC Radio Network. Tuesday, March 19th on the Crystal Silence League and Syndication will be the Astral Power Part 8. And Tuesday, March 19th on the Witch, the Priestess, and the Cauldron in Syndication with Miss Elvira and Phoenix LeFay will be the topic of Circle Sanctuary. And Wednesday, March 20th on the Now You Know Show in Syndication with Professor Porterfield will be the topic of Psalms 23 and Grains of Paradise. And Thursday, March 21st at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on the Witch, the Priestess, and the Cauldron with Miss Elvira and Deb Voith will be the topic of Balancing Our Elemental Energies. And next Sunday, March 24th at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour with Catherine Ironwood and Conjure Man will be Papa G on the topic of Zoological Magic. Support for this program is provided by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in Forestville, California, and located online at luckymojo.com, and by the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, AIR, a directory of ethical and authentic conjure practitioners located online at readersandrootworkers.org, and by Hoodoo Psychics, the first psychic line run entirely by Hoodoo practitioners. Receive a reading with a trusted rootworker instantly. Call 1-888-4-HOODOO or visit Hoodoo Psychics. And by the Crystal Silence League, a free online prayer service of the Association of Independent Spiritual Churches located online at crystalsilenceleague.org. Thank you to all of our sponsors, and back to you, Reverend Art.
And I remembered to unmute myself before I started talking. I'm counting that as a win.
Yay!
All right, so, you know, Doc Murphy always brings some really outstanding topics, and tonight is no different. I know a lot of, you know, ethical eclecticism. A lot of people probably saw that and went, wow, they just busted out all of their SAT words for tonight. but it actually goes beyond that. And, you know, I'm just going to say at the onset here, you know, I've met, for lack of a better way to put it, gatekeepers in just about every path. And I'm pretty sure that if anyone is so inclined as to be a gatekeeper, they're going to be a little upset with the concept of ethical eclecticism. Reverend James's triple word score. Don't play me in Scrabble. But you know, there is a time and a place where paths will converge, where traditions will meet other traditions and birth new baby traditions that continue, that grow off into yet another direction. This is kind of the way things have been. And with that, I think I'm going to have you take this, Doc Murphy, and let's talk about ethical eclecticism.
I'd be happy to. And kind of how I'm going to start this conversation is I actually did workshops at festivals about this particular topic a couple of years ago. And so it's really great to be able to revisit this. Saying at the outset, you know, I have a doctorate in cultural anthropology, and anthropology is the study of human cultural adaptation. As I've said, our adaptive mechanism to our environment was to create culture. With that, it's all that it's ever been is adaptation when cultures encounter each other. Anyone who is running on the assumption that at one point in ancient times there was a culture that existed and it was somehow this thing called pure or untouched or something, and then it's just all kind of fallen to hell with all getting mixed up, you're not in an accurate place. Human beings, when they encounter each other, human cultures, when different groups of people encounter each other, they're inevitably, in whatever situation, going to rub shoulders. And either through acts of peace or war, of trade or marriage or commerce or conquest or resistance, any of these social forces that bring cultures together and pull them apart, there is going to be the combining of ideas. And kind of what I'm going to do is with this combining of ideas or this collaboration of cultures is that I'm going to kind of throw out some terminology and some kind of words because I'm going to be using them a lot, and if people kind of are on board with knowing these words and what they mean, we'll have a vocabulary to talk about what we're talking about. And the first one I want to talk about is the word appropriation, okay, because it is thrown about a lot, both in accurate ways but also in accusatory ways that are inaccurate. And I know it is a thing. I've heard it is a thing on social media to throw the word appropriation around.
Oh, my gosh.
A lot of people don't realize.
Get me started.
And a lot of people aren't using it correctly, because there's appropriation and then there's misappropriation. And appropriation is a cultural force. It happens. It's not good. It's not bad. It's what happens between cultures when they bang into each other and they look at what the other culture is doing and go, that's a good idea. We're going to do it too. Whether or not the exchange is fair or not is irrelevant. It's just a force. Back in anthropology, we used to use terms like cultural diffusion and syncretism and all sorts of other words that were not as heaped on with forced meaning as the word appropriation is. It's essentially the same process. You get two cultures that bang together, or three cultures, or four that bang together, and somehow through that social force that brought them together, exchanges, practices, customs, language, ideas, it's the same force. And whether or not it's, you know, fair or not, that's irrelevant. We're talking about a process. The word misappropriation, I think, is really the word that folks want to use when they're talking about things that are inaccurate and wrong and hurtful. If you're misappropriating somebody's cultural background or language or customs, you're walking in with no knowledge of who they are and no particular caring of learning about who they are. It's not looking at a fellow culture alongside of you and kind of deciding to make those exchanges. It's coming in very ignorantly and saying something like, oh, this is cool, or I feel like I'm this, and just taking it and believing, this is the important part, believing that you now have some business being a spokesperson for that culture when you really don't know anything about it, or when you're trying to profit from it. The idea of cultural property is a fairly new idea, but we also now live in a time that didn't exist in decades past, where people can design things, create things, and sell them and become very wealthy without any acknowledgement of, you know, the cultural background of what it is that they're using. So I definitely want to throw out that there is a difference between appropriation and misappropriation. You want to avoid misappropriation, but there's a way to avoid misappropriation. Appropriation needs to be used less and less as a loaded term. And I actually am starting as an anthropologist to have this talk with folks. Like, look, appropriation is inevitable because the world isn't fair and these forces happen. So I just kind of wanted to lay those terms out so that as we use them, people don't get confused. In anthropology, we don't condone or we don't condemn when we're collecting information about cultures. We observe and we document. And there are times when one culture encountering another is harmful. It's powerful. There's other times where it's peaceful and the exchange is fair. There's other times when they're forced together under circumstances that are out of their control. And how human beings adapt is by taking great ideas, either that they invent on their own or that they see in other cultures, and bring them in so that they can continue to adapt and survive. So I have a vested interest as an anthropologist and did as a professor of getting students to learn about, understand, appreciate cultures that were not the ones that they grew up in and to not be afraid of them. I am not a big fan of the whole stay in your lane thing when people point fingers and accuse each other of misappropriation or appropriation. Step into the lane, but do it humbly and with a genuine interest in somebody else's culture. And if you don't understand something, you know, humble yourself to ask. And if there's parts of that particular culture's practices or traditions that don't belong to you, don't get angry and think that, you know, because you're a nice person, that you can just walk in and take it. You know, it's cultural exchange is also about relationships. And I think people forget that. And I noticed that a lot of the, you know, hurling of accusations of wicked evil appropriation are done by people who don't even know much about the culture that they think is being appropriated. You know, some of it is also, I'll just come right out and say it, racial policing. You know, you're white, you shouldn't be doing that. You're black, you shouldn't be doing that. Well, you know, race isn't a culture and appearance isn't a culture. But like I said, there's a lot of folks that are putting themselves forward as quasi-gatekeepers. And, you know, on what grounds and what business do they have? Have you talked to the culture that you think you're protecting to see how much they want to actually share and educate people about their culture? So I just kind of wanted to throw out that nice kind of messy anthropological soup and a few terms so that when we start talking about it, you know, I'm a little bit clearer, but also people can ask for clarification. So that was the closest thing to a lecture you're going to get. And roll back and forth, because eclectic was definitely a word that was used in the pagan community a lot, especially early in its existence in the earlier decades, as a way to kind of describe somebody who wasn't, you know, people that weren't tied to a particular Wiccan lineage. You know, if you were Gardnerian or Alexandrian or fairy tradition, you know, Vikram Kaur Anderson, any of those where you could definitely, they definitely sussed out whether or not you were legit in the community by whose lineage you were in, right? That meant a great deal back then. It's optional now as more and more people are born into a pagan family. But it was, eclectic was a way of people saying, look, yeah, we trade with Gardnerians, but we also, you know, study with these people, and we're also communing with these people, and we use all their traditions, and they all work. So we're just eclectic. We just kind of do it. Or the kind of bootstrap traditions where you kind of read about traditions and you went, well, we're not going to wait to go to a festival or a con. We're going to figure it out here. Like they did in Paganistan. And then they called themselves, you know, Minnesota eclectic or American eclectic, which was, you know, definitely still had kind of connotations of being about Wicca. And then as people spread out and started realizing that there are other forms of paganism, you know, we have a lot of heathen witches now, or we have a lot of, you know, Reiki druids and stuff. And there's some people that would hear that kind of combining and think, well, this isn't locked into a lineage. There's something just kind of weird about this. And really, when you get right down to it, human beings are much more complex and much more influenced by what's going on around them than any one particular lineage. You know, people grow up with mixed ethnic heritage. People grow up with mixed religious heritage. People travel the world. People meet each other in school or in college, or that are not like them and have good experiences. Some people take classes and courses, like I did, where you learn and you find your mentors, inhabit so many different traditions. And you just realize that, look, I, as a complex human being with a complex mind and a complex spirit, do not have to decide on one of these to follow and then leave the others behind. I simply refuse to do it. I'm beyond eclectic. I joke with my friends and say, I'm the wingnut in the group, because you just won't pin me down. You just won't. I will not turn my back on all the valuable lessons I learned from all of my teachers and all the various religious traditions that I've learned from. So how do you be ethically eclectic? The important part of the whole argument is to be ethical, and we can definitely go into that a little bit more. But I wrinkle more and more these days at the word eclectic, especially in the pagan community, because I think it's just kind of become a lazy catch-all for just somebody who just mixes things up. I definitely try to push forward that if you think that you have to get stuck on a tradition or a lineage, or, you know, if you choose to commit to a lineage or a tradition because you love it and you love the history of it and you love the founders of it and you love the liturgy and that's what makes you want to dance on the table with joy, but for heaven's sakes, do it, you know. But if you're like a lot of folks here in Paganistan who just are endlessly curious, endlessly fascinated, love to see how other cultures express ritual and joy and celebration, and are often invited into those spaces because, you make those connections. I say you don't understand how folk religion works if you get too stuck on committing to a particular, tradition. Folk religions around the world are all about where you are, who's around you, who's conquered you, who you've conquered, and taking whatever works around you, and that becomes part of your practice, part of your relationship with spirit, and part of your identity. That's how most religion is done, is folk style like that. So I'm definitely trying to push forward a terminology like folk paganism or folk religious paganism. Not in opposition to people who abide by a tradition, but to remind people that if you're talking about religion of the people rather than the institution, this is the way it's done. So, trying to think more in terms of, again, eclecticism or mixed heritage or syncretic traditions being really the norm for human behavior and human religious practices rather than these institutions that are imposed on people.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was wrapping up. Go for it.
I was going to say, from a definitional standpoint, I do think that, a lot of people fall to the word eclectic. And I do agree, in a lot of cases, it does kind of feel a little lazy at this point. Not to take away from that concept, but kind of like what you were saying about people haven't taken the time to immerse themselves in these different cultures to take part, to understand, I am naturally curious. If you invite me to a circle that I've never attended before, I will be more than happy to join. I want to learn. Doesn't mean it's going to become a part of my practice, but I will respectfully understand and learn. But I think a lot of the hangups come from, moral laziness of that approach to understanding, and where we're losing the language between the groups to be able to describe really who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It sure does. I mean, I actually created a word when I was writing my dissertation. When you're an academic, you can make up your own words. And I actually called it polyaffiliation. It happens a lot here in Paganistan, where people are, you know, maybe initiated in a witchcraft tradition. And then they go hang out with the Druids. And then they hang out with the Druids, and they learn from the Druids. And then also they go to a few heathen bloats and realize that that's part of their heritage, too, and they want to be involved in that. And then they read about Shinto. And they decide to have a Shinto shrine in their house, too, because they want to honor the kami. And then you realize that this, this is kind of de rigueur here in Paganistan, where people are this and that and that and that, and really here nobody blinks an eye. I think in some communities that's still kind of looked at as, you know, with their eyebrows up or askance of, you know, or still sort of the old idea of, oh, can't you make up your mind who you are? This is all of who I am, right? So but polyaffiliation is kind of a big SAT professor doctorate kind of word. So I think folk brings it down to earth a little bit more, and really that's the truth. The mixing. I'm noticing some of the comments in the chat about gatekeeping, and I only wanted to share this because this it was a humorous way to present it, but also really hit home. I was talking precisely about this topic at a festival a couple of years ago, and there was a young, very talented witch. He was mixed heritage, Indigenous American, African American, and also was gay, but just sort of the many axes of identity. Intersectional is the word I think they use now. And was really helpful to kind of get us to understand the whole gatekeeping thing, because what he said was, you know, people are getting up in arms and gatekeeping to protect, oh, us poor lowly folks from these white people stealing our sage, right? Well, you know what? You're getting all up in arms about sage and how people shouldn't appropriate it. He says, but you know what? You know what else is native to our culture? Tomatoes and coffee. I don't see you getting up in arms and saying that you need to gatekeep our coffee or gatekeep our tomatoes. There seems to be some things you're very selective about gatekeeping. And by the way, none of us asked you to put any gates up, okay? We know how to take care of how to talk to you about our stuff ourselves. And it was just like, yep, that's what we're talking about there. Or when I was a TA for my dear mentor, John Boatman, you know, he taught American Indian Studies. In particular, I TA'd the course Western Great Lakes American Indian Philosophy, and that's where he talks about a lot of the spiritual practices of that he learned from his elders. And, you know, there are things like, you know, spirit communication and rituals and out-of-body communications, spirit and the soul, and, you know, all sorts of things that for sometimes a student would just be like, this is really ringing true for me. This rings true for me so much more than being raised a Christian ever would. We hear this a lot in the pagan community. Oh, this is grabbing me more, and I'm making a connection with it more than I ever did this institutional religion I brought up in. But they were very honest, because a lot of kids were white, and they would say, but I just don't want to, you know, I just don't want to come in here and take this and practice it. I want to be able to experience this connection, but I want to do it the right way. I don't want to do wrong by Indigenous folks, and I don't know what to do about it. And I didn't know what to say at that point, you know. So I went back to John and I talked with him about it. And I said, you know, there's a lot of students that are really taking in, you know, experience with, you know, relationship with Great Spirit and with the land and with the earth and the Red Road and all these other things that he's been introducing them to, and they see this as more true to themselves. But they're white, and they don't want to do wrong by First Nations folks. And frankly, John, I don't know what to tell them. And John looked at me over his glasses and said, you want to pray Indian style? Pray Indian style. That's between you and Great Spirit. You just don't get to run around calling yourself an Indian. Get it? Got it, John. Yep, no problem. So ultimately, your relationship and how you practice it and what you want to, between you and the gods or the spirits or the ancestors, whatever, is your business. But, you know, before you make yourself any sort of cultural ambassador, you know, make sure that you actually get involved with the culture that you're involved. And I'll get into the kind of the three steps of that as we talk about this. But, yeah, eclecticism, I think, is a catch-all that is lazy. So that's kind of where I stand there too. So.
Well, maybe tonight we will start building that language up for folks, you know, maybe we'll start sparking those conversations between the groups that are, you know, honestly, sincerely lacking. Just in, I know you're not particularly, and by choice, and I'm jealous, not on social media. but from what I see, it really is, you know, there are some levels that you look at in the gatekeeping / appropriation / misappropriation. See, we'll start using some of the new words, conversations, mm-hmm. You know, it hits ridiculous levels. And, mm-hmm. You know, I really, and that's one thing, like Reverend James and I, you know, we take great pains. We go to great pains to really not just research and, you know, academically research. It's not, hey, I'm in a Facebook group that says, you know, Buddhists for mm-hmm. dummies or something like that. you know, we've taken the time. We've done the refuge ceremonies. We have immersed in the cultures in different ways. You know, attended, you know, the different. I totally lost the word. Buddhist temples. Attended sessions at temples. Interviewed Buddhist monks. You know, mm-hmm. and talk to others within the culture and asking them about their experiences. You know, these kinds of conversations are really what we all need to be having. You know, I just saw on Facebook the other day in one of the groups, somebody asked, oh, you know, quote unquote, what kind of witch are you? And I was reading through, oh, I'm a kitchen witch, I'm gardenerian, I'm this, I'm that. And I'm scrolling through and I saw, I'm a Christian witch. And I went, oh no, mm-hmm. this person is about to get roasted.
Yeah. Yeah.
And didn't it happen?
I gotta say that it's not like pagans don't need work on their intercultural folk understanding too. You know, there have always been witches. I mean, if you realize that being a witch is a job description, a spiritual job description, there are witches in religious traditions and folk traditions and cultures all over the world. They may have their own word for it in their language, but that role is always there. There was sort of that back and forth in the early part of the pagan movement and the Wiccan movement where what it meant to be a witch was your religious affiliation. Well, Wicca is a religion. There's a liturgy and a praxis and a foundation myth and a traditional way of doing things if you are Wiccan. Gerald Gardner flip-flopped the terms Wiccan and witch frequently, trying to make some argument that it was derivative of the word Wicca, that the word witch was, and that kind of fell apart with more research. But witches can be any religion that they want to, in the same way that hoodoo practitioners can be in religion that they want to. It is a method, is a magical technology, it's a way of doing things, it's a job description. But also, when you really get into the meat of these Christian witches, listen to the kind of Christianity they're talking about, you know. You know, they may or may not be, you know, Southern-style Baptist Christians, but maybe they've got this really profound relationship with a more Gnostic Christianity, right?
True.
Of course, you know, I ran into a lot of Jewish Buddhists when I was practicing with a Buddhist group back in Milwaukee with my ex-husband. Where they found a way to take the philosophy and the practice and the ritual prostrations of Buddhism, and they kind of fell in with their very easily with their Jewish identity and with their families and cultural groups. They found a really nice fit, and they called themselves Jubus. You know, they were Jewish Buddhists. You're going to find this, and as long as people ascribe to needing a label to figure out who they are, you're going to have these kind of confusions and funny words. We get right down to it and just say, I do me, and I do my thing, and I take the ideas and the praxis of different religious traditions, after studying them and understanding what they mean, or maybe attending, you know, an informational class or two, or visiting a temple or visiting the country, or, you know, hanging out with, being invited in by a family who loves you as a friend, and then saying, okay, you know, I had my first, for example, I had experienced my first Seder, Passover Seder, because back in grad school, I had a Jewish roommate. And he said, we're going to have Seder tonight. I'm going to invite over friends. You know, don't feel like you need to leave. You're part of the family here. And you know, it was very loose and fun and, you know, fun event, but it was still traditional foods and the explanation of the foods and the rituals and everything. And I was like, wow, thank you for inviting me. This is really wonderful. Now, am I going to run out and say, no, I'm espousing how you're supposed to do a Seder on Passover? Hell no. But something like, you know, thinking in terms of what ritual foods mean, or honoring, you know, a traumatic past by getting together and having fellowship with people of the same cultural background, incredibly meaningful. And so I'm going to kind of break it down here. I'm going to kind of get just a little bit lecturely here, just for the sake of time, and also because I know some questions will probably pop up. This kind of, when I was presenting on this workshop, these are the kind of the steps that I outlined, that if you're really interested in being or being kind of folk religionist, to do the work of combining and to do it in an ethical way, how do you go about doing it? You know, first off, get the hell off social media and stop listening to these nincompoops, because, you know, they largely, for the most part, don't know what they're talking about. And also the arena of social media, especially from what the little bit that I've witnessed over people's shoulders and what I've understood, it's just not a place where people are listening to each other talk. You know, this a friend of mine likened it to, you know, it's not a conversation. It's somebody walking into a room, screaming as loud as they can, and then leaving the room and shutting the door behind them. And then somebody else walks in and does the same thing. And she says, that's not a conversation. And very little conversation happens there. So the first thing I tell people is, what's the first step that you could take if you want to be ethical about how you approach learning about other cultures and maybe even incorporating their practices and their histories and songs and philosophies into your religious life? And the first one is, get to know your own culture as much as you can. Find out who you are, right? I am amongst the, like a lot of Americans, an immigrant mixed bag, but the big ones that we definitely could see expressed in my family, like I had an Italian grandfather, I had a Greek grandfather, and they both married Irish women. Already right there, you can see I don't give two shits about any kind of cultural purity, because my ancestors didn't either. So I have had a chance to visit Italy, be able to get an idea of, you know, that part of my ancestry, and to walk those streets and eat the food and flirt with the men and the whole, you know, just experience the history. I mean, there's something about walking through Rome and Venice and Florence with all of the history intact that does make you kind of go, wow, you know, this is part of who I am. I've gotten the chance to be in Ireland and learning of the history of that country and of so many of us who have Irish ancestors here in America, and the devastation of the famine on the country, and why so many Irish folks ended up here in America escaping the famine, and why, how that kind of colored who we are. Bucket list, last trip will have to be to Greece. Eventually I'll get there, but that's where my other grandfather's people are from. And, you know, it was just floating in the air at home, but, you know, it's no surprise that when I glommed onto mythology as a kid, it was Greek and Roman mythology, right? But also, you know, not just the ancient ancestors. I mean, get to know who you are and the cultures of the people that you come from, and also the difficult work. Okay, those of you that are European, find out when in American history your people became white, because that is a lot of what pounds cultural understanding and ancestral understanding out of a lot of folks who are white people, is that they kind of don't know who they are because they were able to adapt to this thing called being an American. very quickly and accumulate that privilege. There's a lot of white folks I bumped into, a lot of white students that I had when I was a professor, that when you said, well, what's your ancestry? Said, oh, nothing. And that is heartbreaking. Of course you're not nothing. Your ancestors are from somewhere. And when you find out where they're from, it first off opens up a whole world about who you are, but also gets you in a better place to understand how you ended up here and what your family endured in order to get you here. So step number one, get to know your own ancestry. Step number two, don't stay there. That's the other mistake people made. I'm Irish and that's all I am and I don't care about anybody else. I'm going to stay in my lane. Wrong answer. Step number two is get to know the culture of the place where you're sitting at right now. I mean, we are definitely sitting up and paying attention to the fact that, yep, we have to acknowledge that we are here on stolen land. It's not ours, but the social processes, fair or not, good or bad, evil, this is kind of where we're at right now. We live in cities, we live in places, we live in, you know, but who's here with us right now? Look around your neighborhood, your city, your town, your workplace. Who's there that you can learn more from? The example I give is that I'm looking out the window right now at my neighbors who are making dinner right now, and I'm getting hungry because it looks really good. And they are Mexican-American family, and they've got this device that they're grilling with, and I'm fascinated by it. I've never seen one like it. It looks like a big wok, but there's also some things going on, and my friends at work who are Mexican-American said, oh, that's called a comal. Yeah, it is like a big wok. It's like a big grill, and they've designed it with a lip in the middle so that you can heat up your meat or grill whatever, but then you can heat your tortillas around the edge. I love it. You know, so, yeah, you've also got to learn about the culture of the place that you are. You know, I live in the Twin Cities. Minneapolis and St. Paul have very different cultural histories, even though they're right smack up against each other. That's interesting. Find out why. What are the immigration patterns of where it is that you live? Who's there now? Eat at some of the restaurants. Get to know some of the people. This is the culture that you're immersed in right now, where you are here. Learn it and learn to appreciate that. And you'll find that, you know, you're going to adopt things just because of where you are in your osmosis, and you can learn to appreciate and be comfortable and be part of the culture that you are sitting in right now. And the other big important one too is, you know, stretch your horizons a little bit, travel, get out of your head and your sense of your identity, get out of your neighborhood and the places that are safe, get on a train, hop a plane, go somewhere that, you know, that is outside of your frame of reference, that is new, and learn what it's like to be a stranger in a culture and to adapt to it. And this is my funny story. The first time I ever traveled out of the country, I was very, very excited. My partner and I at the time drove to Canada. We wanted to go to Montreal and Quebec. And it was just a spring break trip, and we just went. And that was the first time in my little 19-year-old life, being a hairdresser in Beloit, Wisconsin, it's the first time I ever drove around town and the signs were all not in English. They're all in French. It's first time. And so, you know, that, even though, like, duh, of course they're going to be, like, when you actually are driving through and experience it, you're like, wow, it rattles you at first when you've never seen it before, even though it's sensibly, you know that. Logically, when you're happening it, it's like, wow, how am I going to order food? How am I going to, you know? So we drove past a restaurant that was Poulet Free Kentucky, which was Kentucky Fried Chicken and French. So I had a lot of poulet that week because I knew what that word meant. But then you eased into it after a while. You're like, okay, they dine differently here. We don't have to act like Americans. You know, we can just kind of watch and see what's going on. And that was a safe place to do my first international travel too, because, you know, they're bilingual in Montreal and Quebec. So you walk into a store, and let's say you're looking at something, and a salesperson comes up to ask you for help, and she asked me a question in French, and I said, oh, I'm sorry. And without even hesitating, she went, hi, can I help you with anything? And just clicked right into English, you know. They code switch very quickly. It was a great place to start that process. But I was like, oh, okay, I think I got it now. So then when I did get a chance to go to other places where they didn't bother with talking to you in English, thank you very much, it wasn't kind of a freak-out situation. It was enlightening and educational. So I think there's those three steps. Get to know yourself. get to know where you are situated in the culture you're in right now. You know, don't hang out with the ancients. you know, do that for a little while, but then, you know, be where you are and then stretch and then do the real work of getting to know people of other cultures and humbly learning from them. And, you know, when you become friends with people of other cultures, they want to share with you the things that they love about their culture and be gracious about those gifts.
I think that's a huge part of it is that gratitude,
mm-hmm.
having and showing the gratitude back where, you know, in some cases I can see some justification and people being flat out pissed because, you know, people would all, you know, take but no give. And I can understand that mm-hmm. to an extent. But, you know, that having the gratitude to accept the gifts of these individuals from these different cultures, these different magical practices, these different walks of life, you know, different healing modalities, whatever, you know, have the presence of mind to accept that with gratitude and be authentic about it.
Yes. And boy, authenticity is a loaded word in and of itself. But when you really get right down to the actual meaning of authenticity is don't pretend to be somebody that you're not, but you have to know who you are in order to not pretend you're somebody that you're not. A graciousness, you know, a humility when you meet folks and a respecting of, because there are boundaries in some cases, right, that you do need to honor. There are some things that you're not supposed to know unless you're invited in, initiated, respect those boundaries that are not for you. And another example, I have an altar here in my own apartment to the Orishas, who have been great guides and great, you know, I venerate them a great deal. I am not an initiate in any African diaspora religion. One of my advisors in graduate school is a Voodoo Houdon, who gone from Haiti and took his class on African diaspora religions. And he and I became wonderful friends, and he became a mentor. He was on my committee, and he's a beautiful friend of mine. I miss him terribly, but I call him from time to time to check on him. So much of what I've learned about relationship with the spirits was from him. But I certainly know that I am not a practitioner or initiate of voodoo or Santeria or Regla de Ocha, or I'm not even going to pretend. But you can, in your own way, honor these spirits. Do enough reading, do enough study, kind of listen to how relationships, you know, can come about in your own way. And what I tell people is that, like, I am an American pagan who has a shrine to the Orishas. I honor the Orishas. I am no initiate, and I do not know that religion as practice. Academically, I know a lot about it, but I'm not a practitioner. And, you know, so don't have me come to your events and have me speak to you on African diaspora religions as a practitioner. You won't get accurate information out of me. I'm not a practitioner. I'm not an initiate. Can I give you academic information about it? Sure. I could teach classes about it, but you're not going to get the same knowledge as somebody who's an initiate, right? That doesn't mean you can't honor the Orishas as somebody who's not an initiate. In fact, they kind of like to hear that they have relationships with folks that aren't initiates. There are ways to create your own relationships with, let's say, entities or gods or spirits or ancestors of another culture that isn't necessarily pretending that you're part of the culture when you're not, or pretending that you're part of the tradition when you're not. And sometimes creativity comes into play as well. Maybe you're honoring the spirits of a particular religious group, and you are, as you're venerating them, learning who they are. Hay River Fire Haven, many of our members have really developed a close relationship with the Slavic growing process for them. You know, first came the personal gnosis experiences, and then they had to understand what those experiences meant and what the symbolism meant. And then as they dug, they learned about this culture, and they learned about these gods, and they went, well, great, well, maybe this is it. Then they traveled to those parts of the world and went, oh, my God. Then they came back to their land, and they built shrines to them, and now we've all learned about these deities. And when we go visit them, it's like, well, hi, Velas. Hi, well, gosh, we're not Slavic, but we're going to hand you a drink. Because now you're a friend. And realizing that, like, you can establish those sorts of relationships with divinity. They don't care about cultural boundaries, is what we found if you're talking about relationship with spirit. It's people that can sometimes be the problem. So that's kind of where I'm in the same way that if you've ever been in a college classroom, and a lot of your classmates are not from the same place that you are. You know, one of my first college classes, I'm this hairdresser from Beloit, Wisconsin, and I'm in a class with students from Turkey and Singapore and Malaysia and Poland and Russia, all in the same class. And I thought I'd just died and gone to heaven. I'm like, look at, I'm learning, you know, you got the entire world and so many new friends that can teach you so many new things. And that's how you approach learning about and understanding culture. People will happily share with you if you happily are humble and say you really truly want to learn. And then once you do, don't walk away and say, thank you for giving me what I needed, goodbye. Stay involved in those relationships that you've cultivated. So.
You know, there's actually an interesting question Troll T just posted into the chat. Is personal gnosis valuable, and what is it best for?
Of course. But here's the thing. One of the most annoying phrases that has come to pop up, especially in pagan circles, is unverified personal gnosis. I can't stand that phrase. It's ridiculously redundant. First, unverified personal gnosis. Of course it's unverified. It's personal. Drop that word. It's redundant. And also, what is gnosis? Well, it's a individual personal sensory experiential realization of religious truth. Again, it's personal. You don't need to say it's personal gnosis. It's just gnosis. You don't need to say it's unverified because it, duh. So I think adding all of those modifiers on the front of gnosis is just people being anxious and people being neurotic and being afraid that their gnosis is going to be taken to. I don't know. I don't understand it. We've never had a problem with the idea of gnosis ever until recently, where people suddenly like, well, I had gnosis, but we really shouldn't take that too seriously. It's like, you're not going to empirically verify anyone's gnosis. As I said before, magic ain't science. So I go back to what the religious scholar William James said, and I go back to this a lot, which was, you know, you are the 100% unquestioned expert of your own religious experience. If you dreamt that you're dancing with angels, you're dancing with angels. No one can tell you that you don't have your truth. But that doesn't mean other people can take your truth uncritically. We do have the right to say, when somebody says, I was dancing with angels last night, we do have the right to say, yeah, okay. What'd you have to eat last night? Just to, you know, I was everything. Or if somebody says, I had a terrible dream and I'm afraid I might be hexed. All right, let's walk back through here. Maybe you just had too much to eat and you had a nightmare versus, okay, maybe there's an important lesson here that's none of our business, or maybe you need to see a mental health professional. You don't have to take what other people say uncritically as truth for everybody, but everyone is the arbiter of their own true religious experience, and that's what gnosis is. No one's gnosis is going to be the same. So that's kind of where I get into, you know, too many people are tangling. Somebody comes along and says, I have a personal, you know, gnosis experience, or I have a gnosis experience, and this is what I believe as a result of that. Well, no one asked the peanut gallery to horn in on what your personal experience is. It's yours, right? But people always seem to want to. If anyone's, you know, there's been a lot of religious traditions that are based on creating a dogma around somebody's personal gnosis experience. But we see what's become of that, right? That's where you get sort of the charismatic leaders of sometimes problematic religions. So anyway, I'm not
With little discussions on Kool-Aid and things of that nature. Problematic religion.
Okay. Yeah, and they're called deviant religions, actually, and in religious studies movements, because somebody did the work, and religions like that that end up with, you know, let's face it, crime and violence and that sort of thing. My other advisor, Jim Lewis, this is an area of his expertise. It's like going into, like, why do suicide cults happen? Why do these sorts of things happen? And when an organization is 75% of their existence is recruiting, that's not a religion. There's something else going on there. And likewise, that's about, you know, power relationships. It's really not what we're discussing here, though that might be a topic for a show that we can broach is you know, how to know when your religion is or your order or whatever else is a problem as opposed to, you know, legit. But, you know, people have personal gnoses all the time, and that governs often how they structure their spiritual relationships. I mean, when Joseph had a dream that an angel came to him and said, don't go back to Israel. King Herod's going to kill the baby. Go to Egypt instead. Nobody sits there and goes, well, that's whatever his crazy unverified personal gnosis. Or when Harriet Tubman dreamt of Moses and that influenced her to create the Underground Railroad. There wasn't a peanut gallery around her going, well, that's some crazy unverified personal gnosis. You know, we take that as she had a dream and she made her dream manifest, and it was astounding how it changed history, right? A lot of the bickering about how verifiable personal gnosis is a lot of insecure people taking up space in a room, right? So that's where that is. And, you know, you've got to be able to trust your own experiences if you're going to follow a folk path or an eclectic path or a mixed tradition path. When those experiences tell you, go ahead and explore everything. But it also, again, requires a great deal of understanding the externals, you know. Okay, if you have a dream about Black Hawk coming to visit you in a dream, that's not necessarily a call to take up practicing in a, you know, Native American style religion. It may be a call to something else, but this is a symbolism that's speaking to you, and that causes you to study and to research and to dig a little bit. And then when you learn what exactly you're supposed to learn, it'll make sense, right?
You know, when we talk about a lot of this, and there's been a hell of a chat going on in the chat room as well, you know, discussing.
I know, I
got to
get caught up on it here. Let me scroll through here. And
you know, when we break it down to that, the ethics and morality of, you know, the sort of eclecticism, I'm going to use the lazy word for lack of a better one at the moment. You know, it really does break down to the need to develop the languages, to develop and create the safe places to be able to have these discussions. You know, I would honestly say before the advent of social media, we had the opportunity, even with having the chat rooms and things of that nature, that came about with the advent of the internet, we were still having intelligent discussions in large part.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like this hold my beer mentality of who can one up who.
Right.
Or, you know, I'm the 18th degree high priest master fornicator such and such of the cult of so and so. It's like, where the hell did you take the time to come up with some of this shit? But,
mm-hmm.
you know, we need to get back to the salon. We need to get back to the cafe discussions. The oh, hey, you know, I see you do such and such. Can you talk to me about that? And we need to be we need to get back to being okay with showing our vulnerability that there might be something we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay. It's okay to not know. It's okay to admit that you don't know. And it's okay to ask. You will be the better person for it. You will grow from it. You will build bridges that you quite possibly couldn't have imagined building.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it's like the old, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, everybody's trying to be the damn influencer. I hate that word. I hate that social media influencer bullshit word. It, to me, I don't want to be influenced. I want to be educated.
The cloud just opened above my head. Oh, yay.
Influence is for the weak-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Educate me.
Preach it.
Teach me.
Preach it.
Show me. Don't coerce me. Don't, you know, put your little bend on things to get me to see your side.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have these honest discussions. And I think, you know, we can have, we're having one tonight.
Mm-hmm.
There is a ton of additional conversations that we can continue to have, even just from what we've started this evening.
Mm-hmm. It's like the story of the very gifted Zen monk who was a Buddhist monk who was sent up to the mountains to learn from, you know, the great master who lived in the cave. Very educated, great guy. Everyone loved him. He loved everybody. Smart, skilled, kind of knew everything. And so his teacher said, okay, it's time for you. You're going to be an apprentice to the guy in the mountain. So up he went very eagerly, very nervously, bowed before the master when he got to the cave. And the master said, so tell me about yourself, about you learned at the monastery. Your teacher spoke very highly of you. And the young monk very humbly and eagerly, you know, talked about the studies and the practices and everything that he'd done ever since he was a child. And the master said, that's very impressive. No, that's really wonderful. Your teachers were right to send you here. All right, I will take you on as my apprentice, as my acolyte. Here's your first rule. Yes, master. And he said, anytime I tell you something, you don't ever disagree with me. You don't argue back. You just do what I tell you. Okay, yes, master. So the second one is, that's the main rule. And he says, okay, so here's my first, what I'm going to ask you to do first. He says, put on a light of fire, boil some water, and make me some tea. So the young apprentice says, oh, here comes, just fix the fire, boils the water, perfect tea ceremony, everything, just everything's perfect. He knows exactly what he's doing. And then the master says, thank you. He says, now I want you to pour me a cup of tea, and I don't want you to stop pouring until I tell you to stop. Oh, yes, my master. And so he pours the tea, gets halfway up the cup. He looks at the master. Master says nothing. Gets to the lip, looks at the master. Master says nothing. It starts to spill over the lip of the cup and spill onto the ground. He keeps looking. Master says nothing. Pretty soon there's a puddle of tea all over the floor because he hasn't stopped pouring. Then finally the student goes, master, I don't understand. He says, I can't, I can't give you any more tea. When do you want me to stop? I can't get any more tea in the cup. It's full. And the master says, so it is with your mind. Empty it, and I may be able to fill it with something. And how often do we walk into, this is what the whole social media is saying. I think I know a lot, and I'm going to tell you about all the stuff that I know. You're not going to learn anything until you empty your head and get humble. You won't. But, you know, that's how you have to approach any kind of cultural combining, is with humility. Rather than, you know, perceived knowledge.
You know, humility, that the ability of being, you know, that humbleness, that humility, it really, it's almost become, how do I want to put it? I don't want to say like a swear word, but kind of, you know, it's become an unwanted, or not an unwanted, but an uncelebrated trait, that if somebody has humility, they're found to be weak.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally posit humility isn't weak. Humility has a strength that will propel beyond force.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my 2 cents on humility.
I'm with you there too. Humility isn't about putting yourself down, and humility isn't—it's just accepting that, you know, it's being true, and part of being true is knowing when you know something and knowing when you don't. It's not subservience, it's not submission. It's just very simply not believing that you are better than anybody else. I mean, think about that. You know, even down to like my football team is better than your football team. Well, really, we get right down to it. That's kind of what a lot of this identity posturing is for a lot of people on social media and in other places. Academia is ripe with it too. Don't get me started on that. But the minute you walk into a room and say, you know what, I'm here to learn. I'm very proud of who I am and my cultural heritage, but I'm not better than anybody else in the world, and I want to learn more. You know, what a marvelous place to start your journey, and a marvelous place to be. But you're right, in a culture like ours that is very, you know, ego celebratory. That's hard for a lot of people to wrap their heads around. Whereas in other parts of the world, that's normal, you know?
You know, I tend to take the definition of humility away from that, a low self view, and being more of humility as being recognition of your place in relation to the rest of society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that interconnected network, that we're all brothers, sisters. There is no one person, one way better than another. And it just, there's the music. I just looked up and I'm like, the music's going to be coming. Oh, I want to keep this going, but that's all the time we have for tonight. We're going to have to come back for this one, Doc Murphy. We hope you've enjoyed time with us, everyone, this evening. Until next time we meet, let's keep that magic alive. Take us out, Reverend James.
Thank you, Reverend Art, and thank you, Doc Murphy of RootDocMurphy.com and the Twin Cities of Paganistan for joining us this week. We invite you to join us next week when we'll be welcoming back to the studio the wonderful Reverend Roy of HealingAmulet.com in Nashville, Tennessee. We've come to the end of this episode of Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places, brought to you by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in Forestville, California, on the LMC Radio Network. You can find Reverend Art at FolkConjure.com and at FolkConjure on Facebook and Instagram, on the Lucky Mojo Forum at forum.luckymojo.com, on readersandrootworkers.org, and on Hoodoo Psychic. I'm your announcer, Reverend James, joining you from FolkConjure.com in North Carolina. Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places can be heard every week live on Blog Talk Radio at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, and the shows are available in archive via mysticsmages.com/radio show and on the Lucky Mojo Forum. For all of us at Mystics and Mages, I'd like to thank you for being here, and be sure to follow at Mystics Mages and Magical Places on Facebook and at Mystics Mages Magical Places on Instagram for updates and news. We'll be back next week at the same time. Come sit a spell. Wink, wink. Relax and enjoy the show. We've only just begun. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
I do want to shout out again, Doc Murphy. Fantastic discussion. You always bring those topics that just, they get right down into the heart of the matter. Hopefully, we need to schedule part two, and we need to do it fast. Always
okay.
A joy to have you here. Till next week, everybody, many blessings. Have a wonderful week. Peace.